Welcome to the 473rd episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Welcome, and thank you for listening. Last week, I had dinner with one of my best friends from medical school, and she brought up that in a year, we will be having our 40th anniversary as med school graduates. She said, that's a long time to be a doctor. And I said, it certainly is. And we talked about our futures and what we were going to do and our passions. And we both still have a great passion for medicine and helping people. And we still both have frustrations because we were trained classically to actually talk to people and treat them as a whole person, not just as a pregnant woman. She's a high-risk obstetrician at Tufts, or me just as a heart, a cardiologist. So it was a great conversation, and neither one of us are retiring anytime soon, but are looking to find people that really want to participate in their health and realize that that is a huge challenge to find people that are just not looking for perhaps a quick way out or somebody to just give them a magic bullet and let them eat what they want or pick the diet that suits them best and ignore all the other risk factors because it doesn't matter in that particular diet. So anyway, I digress. But along those lines of graduation, I graduated from West Virginia University Medical School, and then I went to University of Pittsburgh for the next 6 years to do my residency and fellowship. And there was a study that just came out of University of Pittsburgh looking at atrial fibrillation and the age at which people present. And it looked at about 67,000 people over a 19-year period. And the trend is getting worse. The trend for people being diagnosed with atrial fibrillation at a younger and younger age is increasing, and more of them are actually having increased mortality and increased symptoms of congestive heart failure. Atrial fibrillation is what you would call the bread and butter arrhythmia of a cardiologist. We see more of atrial fibrillation than probably any other arrhythmia. So in the past 38, 39 years, I've seen a lot of atrial fibrillation. And the treatments have changed a little bit. We now have ablation that can eliminate some of the atrial fibrillation episodes, but we really haven't got a handle on how to prevent it. And frankly, most cardiologists don't even try to look at prevention of atrial fibrillation. Once you have it, you have it. Treat the atrial fibrillation, control the rate, put people on blood thinners so they don't throw blood clots to their brain and have strokes, and they'll live happily ever after. And for years, we've said that, don't worry, won't kill you any quicker as long as we keep the rate under control and you take your blood thinners and you don't have a stroke. But that's becoming less true with regards to the mortality associated with atrial fibrillation. And part of it has to do with the risk factors that cause atrial fibrillation and the risk factors associated with atrial fibrillation. So just to make a quick brief discussion on what is atrial fibrillation. It's atria, fibrillation, fluttering, fibrillating at the top chambers of the heart, particularly the left atrium. And so there's not a normal conduction from the sinus node down through the AV node and a beat occurs. So there's a bombardment of the AV node or the middle aspect of the heart with over 250 beats a minute, quivering of the top chamber, and then the bottom chamber is trying to beat out of sync. And however good that AV node is in the middle is basically how many beats get through. So typically a person can have an atrial fibrillation rate off of medications well into the hundreds, and it's out of sync, so they typically get short of breath. And maybe that's their only symptom. Some people can feel their heart rate, some people can't. But a fast heart rate with when you're not doing anything at all, shortness of breath with exertion, can be a symptom of atrial fibrillation. And then people note that their heart rate is irregularly irregular. So it's just all over the place. It could be, you know, 80, 90, 110, back to 70, you know, all over the place. And that quivering of the top chamber leads to blood clot formation in that top chamber, and is specifically in a little nook and cranny called the left atrial appendage. And so when blood clots, you know, the blood turns more like we describe it as a milkshake rather than water. So the thickened blood, because of the clots and the turbulent flow, form little clots that settle down into that little left atrial appendage, and they can come out like the bingo balls at a bingo, whatever that machine is that spits the balls out for bingo, and they come out and they fly to the straightest target, which is typically the brain. So people can actually present with a stroke as their first symptom of atrial fibrillation, which can be very, very scary and very, very devastating. It doesn't take long, or you don't have to be in atrial fibrillation very long to start to form those clots. And the worst part is, if people come out of it back into a regular rhythm, oftentimes that left atrial appendage doesn't resume normal contractility, so the clots can kind of be present or form for several weeks thereafter, making the risk of what we call an embolic event or a stroke more likely. So you'd like to avoid atrial fibrillation, and if you have it, you'd like to be on blood thinner so you don't get those clots forming, or you decrease the risk of those clots forming. And the other thing is when the heart is not beating in sync, if it's beating fast for long periods of time, then one can develop congestive heart failure because the heart muscle just can't perfuse itself, and it literally starts to malfunction, or the ejection fraction, the amount of blood with each beat starts to decline. Usually it's reversible, but if the atrial fibrillation goes untreated for prolonged periods of time, that can develop into what we call cardiomyopathy, or permanent decrease in cardiac function. So first and foremost, you'd like to avoid atrial fibrillation, but if you have it, you need to accept it and you need to treat the risk of it. Again, medications to either get people back into a regular rhythm is usually the best bet, but studies have shown that as long as you can control the rate and it's not too fast, then most people don't end up having cardiac dysfunction. The biggest thing is to try to prevent strokes from happening. So if you can take a medication or remain out of atrial fibrillation, then the risk, obviously, of the embolic events go down. The problem is the medications can also lower blood pressure, so people tend to have a normal blood pressure. Sometimes they don't tolerate the medication. Sometimes they don't tolerate the medications anyway. Your heart rate can be too low when it's in a regular rhythm, too high when it's not. The more potent medications tend to have more side effects, which can be even lethal. Some of the medications can actually cause worsening rhythms of ventricular tachycardia that could actually kill you. So you have to be selective of who you use these particular medications in. Some of the medications can lead to heart failure, so you have to be careful. Some of them have side effects such as fibrosis of the lungs or liver. And even the thyroid, so you have to watch these medications and use those as a last resort. So the advent or the invention or the development of ablation therapies to try to go in and burn those atrial fibrillation pathways have been something that have become very attractive, especially in younger people that would have to spend the rest of their lives on medications that, you know, impede their quality of life. So I'm not going to talk about any of that more just because it's a whole different topic of discussion. But the risk factors being, you know, smoking, overweight, obese, having sleep apnea, having hypertension, and then, of course, valvular heart disease being the big ones. With the amount of obesity in this country, the amount of overweight people, you can see how that would increase the risk of atrial fibrillation. You're straining the heart. When the blood pressure goes up, you're straining the heart and stretching the heart. When people eat a very high sodium diet sometimes and then dehydrated on other aspects of their life, the change in the volume of the heart is enough to kind of trigger one of these atrial fibrillation episodes. But, you know, as opposed to making this diagnosis, I think it's really important that we start to look at people that are at risk and really treat the risk factors. And that's where, you know, all these years of being a cardiologist is very frustrating, because these risk factors for cardiovascular disease, for atrial fibrillation, for cancer, for diabetes, they're all the same. There are being overweight, and that is at the bottom line. Being overweight, having high blood pressure, high cholesterol, being sedentary really increase the risk for a lot of these lifestyle diseases. And by targeting them, we can avoid these changes. You know, once your heart has been stretched and the electrical system is, starting to fray, it becomes much harder to fix than to not have that happen in the first place. So, plant-based nutrition allows people to normalize their body mass index. Watching your sodium intake can decrease hypertension. Exercise, decreasing hypertension, increase blood flow. Decreasing inflammation by a plant-based diet are all good ways to get these risk factors under control and hence decrease atrial fibrillation. So I applaud my colleagues, the electrophysiologists, that will stand there and try to figure out where these pathways are and to burn them. They become more and more successful. There are some devices out there, again, that can be placed in that left atrial appendage to try to keep those clots from embolizing. It's not an exact science. It's not 100%. So it's still best to avoid it. Unfortunately, when people have palpitations or arrhythmias, they often go to the doctor. And early on, people used to get a Holter monitor, which was like a carrying around an old Walkman that had a recording device that you would wear for 48 hours. Then they became smaller, and you could wear them actually for 28 days, a month, and then you turn them in, and the doctor would read them to see whether or not you had any arrhythmias that you needed to worry about. So it was all retrospective. You could put down your symptoms, and they would try to correlate what the rhythm was to people's symptoms. There have been devices since then, loop recorders that are actually implanted, kind of like, some of the spy movies where there's a chip put in people, but there's a little recording device about the size of a, the first little iPod, the tiny little iPod music player, MP3 player. So you put a little device in people and you could actually Wi-Fi and see people if they're having arrhythmias. And so that's one way to get those arrhythmias. But again, they have to be downloaded or people have to contact their doctor because nobody's really watching it all the time. In comes Apple Watch and another device called Cardia that you can get on Amazon, and you can actually download your own EKG. The Garmin Venu device now, and a couple of the other Garmins, I believe some of the Fenix, some of the different models of Garmins, also allow the recording of your own EKG using the pulse oximeter, not the pulse oximeter, but the little infrared light on the back of the watch to actually record an EKG. And they're actually quite accurate. And guess what? When you buy one of those, you don't have to have, the hundreds of dollars from your insurance or pay the doctor to actually implant one of these devices. You can just wear it on your arm and take it off when you want. And they actually provide very good EKGs that you can save as a PDF and send to your doctor at no charge, and they should be able to read it. Most doctors don't want any part of that. Most cardiologists don't want any part of that because, again, there's no billing associated with you doing your own EKG and asking them what it is. So a lot of people won't trust it, but we have found it is very advantageous for our practice. So we have people get the Cardia devices or the iWatch, whatever they prefer. I don't have anybody with the Garmin capability yet, and unfortunately I wear a Garmin Enduro. It doesn't have that capability, but I do carry a Cardia device, and it's just a little strip with an app that can go, you can carry with you, or I actually have mine on a little holder in the back of my phone. And if somebody has an arrhythmia or I would think my heart rate is not right, I can do an EKG right there, save it as a PDF. I can look at it, but I have, ultimately I have my patients send me their EKGs when they think something is amiss. And so we can adjust things. And so I keep a lot of people out of the emergency room because they don't have to go to the emergency room and see what their palpitations are for, because we can often head it off quickly and treat them and get them back in a regular rhythm with medications, and they never have to go to the heart hospital and they never go into heart failure, and we can get things done quickly and early. So if you have palpitations, you might consider getting one of these devices. Some of the devices, I know that Cardia actually has a membership fee. If you don't have a doctor, that somebody will interpret the EKG for you. When it comes up in the PDF, it will give you a baseline reading. It's not always accurate, though. So you kind of need a human, I guess, or somebody with artificial intelligence thing to read it, perhaps, would work as well. I'm not sure about that either. But nevertheless, again, we use it in our practice, and I read them specifically. I don't use artificial intelligence. I use my 38 years of reading EKGs to interpret the EKG. So we know that if you're overweight and you're sedentary, it's a risk factor for things like high blood pressure. If you have high blood pressure, it's a risk factor. Other risk factors you might have would be smoking, a high cholesterol. And there is a lot of argument about cholesterol and statins these days, especially among my carnivore friends, and what that all means. We know that just taking a statin doesn't cure everything. People continue to have heart attacks despite taking statins. Sometimes they need multiple drug regimens to try to bring their cholesterol down. It's still being debated on how low you should go. We know populations that walk around naturally with a cholesterol of about 140 or 150 seem to have a very low incidence of cardiovascular disease. We know that when people are young and don't have genetic abnormalities, they have low cholesterol. So the cholesterol tends to go up in life. People tend to have cardiovascular disease as they get older. The two certainly go hand in hand. But again, not everybody with high cholesterol has a heart attack. And sometimes what becomes the magic number is very debatable. Some would advocate driving the cholesterol down as low as you possibly can. Others, maybe not so much. There's still the question, and as far as I'm concerned, that cholesterol doesn't act as a single player to cause cardiovascular disease. It has to have other factors involved. But as I've described earlier, most of the time, all the other factors are involved. So we have people with diabetes that also have high cholesterol, that are also overweight, that are also hypertensive, and they tend to have cardiovascular disease and cancer and other diseases. So it's very difficult to study any of these things in isolation. There was a study published here recently that looked at LDL versus VLDL, which is basically all the cholesterol that's not LDL, that tends to have more triglycerides in it. So they looked at people that had high LDL and high VLDL, and people that had low LDL and low VLDL. They looked at people that had high LDL and low VLDL, and people that had low LDL and high VLDL. So basically, that tongue twister is basically they're both high, they're both low, one's up, one's down, combinations. And what this particular study found was that triglycerides or VLDL in the company it keeps was much more associated with cardiovascular disease and probably a bigger risk factor for cardiovascular disease than LDL itself. So the worst group had the worst group had high VLDL and low LDL. Unfortunately, most statin in that group also were on statin therapies, a large proportion of them. So statins don't often lower triglycerides. It's pretty hard to lower triglycerides because it tends to be a metabolic disease. So when people have high insulin levels, it tend to break down fat into the bloodstream and have elevated triglycerides. And diabetics that have elevated triglycerides tend to have worse prognosis. And this study, again, kind of leans towards if you have elevated non-LDL, which includes a lot of triglycerides, that's elevated, it's a much worse than even the total cholesterol and LDL by itself. So it throws everything back to cardiovascular disease being more of a metabolic disease or metabolic dysfunction, which everything keeps coming back to, that our mitochondria, we lose muscle mass, we lose mitochondria, we have mitochondrial dysfunction, and we can't metabolize nutrients, specifically carbohydrates, fats, and proteins adequately, and we have a buildup of, and we have high insulin levels, and end up having high triglyceride levels. In the carnivore community, my carnivore friends, there are some that are actually giving up the ghost and adding fruits and vegetables to their diet, recognizing that some fiber and the antioxidants associated with fruits and vegetables are beneficial. But there is a hardcore group out there that, despite seeing market elevations in cholesterol and LDL, are still saying that it doesn't make any difference. You're still much healthier by eating an all-carnivore, all-meat diet. But there is backtracking now, and that it's like, okay, well, if you're lean and metabolically normal and you have a high cholesterol, there's a few coronary calcium studies out there that show that people don't seem to have high calcium scores despite having these markedly elevated cholesterols. So everybody's jumping on the bandwagon, say, see, LDL doesn't matter, cholesterol doesn't matter. But in the background, again, it comes down to metabolically normal. So if you're a young, lean, muscular individual with no cardiovascular comorbidities and you eat a carnivore diet for a few years, it's probably not going to hurt you. But what percentage of that of the population does that actually include? It's exactly like saying if you're a young, lean, strong vegan that eats a vegan diet for a few years, it's probably not going to kill you. Is it going to be the best for you? No, but in a short period of time, is it actually going to take you down? It may not, but that doesn't mean it's going to increase your health span or your longevity. The biggest problem that I see is, again, people hear what they want to hear. They hear that, oh, this guy's had high cholesterol and it's because they're really lean on a carnivore diet. Therefore, I'm going to jump on that bandwagon. I'm going to become lean just eating meat and all my woes will go away. But people aren't metabolically healthy to start with. We have well over 50% of the population pre-diabetic, overweight, sedentary. So the number of lean, muscular, young people walking around is a really small number. So the danger is to have people that are metabolically unstable, metabolically pre-diabetic, high triglycerides, starting to adopt these diets that are driving their cholesterol sky high. And again, just adding another risk factor onto the pile of things that ultimately cause vascular disease, atrial fibrillation, cancer, and so forth. So I think it's a disservice to say that, cholesterol just doesn't matter. Get your calcium score, and if it's zero and you're 45 or 50, you're set for life. It's just not true. Calcified plaques don't show soft plaques. Soft plaques are the one that rupture and cause the acute heart attacks. Calcium scores often don't pick those up. So these people could be walking around with soft plaques that we're not seeing. And certainly there are reports out there where people have had, stents placed for acute infarcts because of their, metabolic risk factors. And then the markedly high cholesterol is driving them over the edge and the lipids and the cholesterol plaques, rupturing and causing clots. And to date, there has never been one study showing a decreased mortality risk or an increased longevity associated with getting calcium scores. It does not predict mortality. One of the reasons is that a positive calcium score may lead to a stress test or an angiogram, which leads to a stent, which leads to a morbidity associated with it or a medication associated with it. So there is a risk of treating coronary artery disease interventionally that is asymptomatic. Most of what I see in the carnivore diet, they don't tend to be big poultry eaters, but as many of you know, with any kind of news references, the bird flu scare is making its way around again. And what does that mean for us? What does it mean for the poultry industry? What does it mean for the meat industry? And, you know, I'll go back to one of the reasons why I became plant-based way back when. When I looked at what the, if I eat the animal and I'm essentially eating everything the animal ate, and I'm eating every toxin that the animal was exposed to. So if the animal was given vaccines, antibiotics, growth hormones, ate genetically modified soybean or corn, or was in a grass field that was sprayed with Roundup, I'm eating everything that that animal ate over all those years. Some people would say, well, poultry don't live as, you know, they're smaller birds, they have less accumulation. But again, with the factory farm chickens, that's probably couldn't be further from the truth. They're probably one of the dirtiest animals that you could consume at this point, and probably one of the worst treated when it comes to the humane treatment of farm animals because of all the factory farming. But with the bird flu, there was an article kind of published that looked at some of the history of vaccination of our poultry and birds and the bird flu. And, it's not a wild bird that gives it to the chicken. It's the chicken that gives it to the wild bird for the most part. And China was actually the first country to start vaccinating their poultry back in 1995. And they actually experienced some of the worst cases of bird flu after that. And it seems as though, as history has played out, that the more a country vaccinates their birds, the more that the influenza, the bird influenza, actually is able to mutate, and more strains are formed and become more and more virulent, and we've never got a hold of it, as proof is in the pudding. But the other thing is that a lot of times the viruses that they're vaccinating the chickens against didn't have any problem. The chickens didn't have any problems with it. So a lot of the chickens were completely asymptomatic, and then they were given a vaccine that ultimately developed a worse mutation of the influenza. France had a similar population with their ducks, so that we don't actually even import them because of the vaccine and the contamination. The technologies to develop vaccines for poultry involve developing viruses in chicken eggs, but they also develop antigens that are produced in genetically modified bacteria inserted in insects. You know, there are DNA type vaccines with adjuvants added to them. So there's a lot of messy things that are given to the chickens that, you know, again, are making these birds very, very unhealthy, especially for consumption and spread of further disease. Right now, there are 43 manufacturers in 11 different countries, most of which are located in Asia, that make these vaccines. The result is chickens that have had lots of adjuvants, whether they're mercury, aluminum, a lot of toxins given to them. So they're quite unhealthy. And on top of that, you know, really are breeding viruses that become more and more virulent. You think about it, you know, chickens in a giant warehouse on top of each other, very dirty environment in their own excrement. They're unhealthy to begin with. Their immune system is compromised. It's just kind of an awful way to think about propagating things where, again, in the natural environment, backyard farms, chickens are outside, they're healthy, they're eating worms, they're, doing what chickens do, and natural immunity would occur. And so before this mass vaccination program of factory farm chickens begun, natural immunity was how things went. So, you know, to me as an outside observer, again, natural immunity is one of the best defenses that we can get. It's been shown in all kinds of animals, whether it's dogs and, you know, that are around little bits of viruses that tend to do much better. Our interventions so far have not proven to make us healthier as individuals, whether it's animals, chickens, dogs, cats, or people. We are day 25 of our walking 5K a day wellness challenge in my practice, And I'm proud to say that we have a small set of early adopters that are doing quite well. We have a few people that have come across that are also trying to start walking on a regular basis. And we also have the people that are just glad to sit back and watch and not really participate. And that follows along pretty closely with adoption of a whole food, plant-based, low-oil diet. There are people that really jump on board and see the benefits and really embrace it. And there are a few that dip their toes in the water. And there are those that would run toward a carnivore diet in a heartbeat, knowing that their LDL may go skyrocketing high, but it's what they would rather hear. I believe the key to success is developing your go-to meals. So find six or seven different plant-based recipes that you like, or even identify six or seven meat-based recipes that you like and see if you can convert them to plant-based recipes. Obviously, a sirloin can't be converted to plant-based. I'm not going to even pretend that a bean burger is like a hamburger for those people that are carnivores out there. But certainly lasagna or a stir-fry can be made plant-based. We do a lot of dishes, soups that we used to do before we were plant-based styles. So chili is one of them. And virtually every soup, burritos and things like that. There are things that people ate that were more plant-based than not before. So taking what you know and tweaking it and then developing a couple more recipes, and some of which that are very, very simple for nights that you just don't want to cook. It has to be somewhat easy, and it has to be something that the whole family can get behind. Last week I talked about salads, but, you know, this week, you know, dinners as far as, you know, making things that people enjoy. Again, you know, lasagnas and soups and burrito night and pizza night, those can all be bases of a rotation. You know, I've had a couple nights where I've done cabbage and mushrooms in a variety of different, you know, with a variety of different flavors and, you know, added beans to that. You can make tofu in a variety of different ways that add that to your diet and your rotation with beans. It's just finding a few things that you like and that you can rotate through. And having a menu and have it in place and having your refrigerator stocked. I always keep peppers in my refrigerator because the green, red, orange, yellow peppers are in there right now. Zucchini is always, almost always on, in my weekly regimen. I have cabbage or bok choy or Napa cabbage in the refrigerator each week. I always have kale in my refrigerator so that I can grab those things. I always have sweet potatoes. I have white potatoes so that we can do potato nights, you know, rice, quinoa as grains that are available. So if you have those basic things stock, I always have mushrooms. So if you just have those on your recurrent basis, you can do a lot of different recipes with just those few things. And once you get a handle on it, you know, once you get in the groove, it makes it very, very easy. And, you know, it certainly beats going out and having some 20-year-old throw a bunch of oil on something and getting indigestion and a bunch of salt and, you know, just poor quality food. And again, if you've heard anything as far as the toxins that are applied to animal products, you should come running over to be plant-based, because even if our plant food is contaminated with some Roundup or some sort of pesticide spray, we're eating very low on the food chain. So the amount of toxins that you're getting from plants is not near what you're getting from an animal that spent 9 months or 12 months eating toxins only for you to eat the animal. So think of it that way. People that are hanging on to fish, again, the fish are swimming around in polluted waters, taking on dioxins and mercury and lead in their fatty tissues. And then you're eating that fish that has those. So if you're trying to clean out your metabolic garage and clean up your diet, decrease your metabolic risk, that's the way to go. So don't be afraid of plants. jump in. If you have any questions, we have multiple ways that you can join our practice to learn more about how to become plant-based with registered dietitian consults every month, or a consult from me and a registered dietitian every month, or being a full member of the practice. Whatever you like, even just if you want to lurk on our website, there's a $25 a month that you can lurk into everything we do, and we post it on our website for a members-only page. Recipes, nutrition classes, mobility classes, you can see it all for $25 a month. So go on over to drdelaney.com, give it a look. I promise you that we can get your health journey headed in the right direction. Thank you, as always, for listening. If you enjoy this podcast and you're one of my soldiers that keep listening and sending me nice things, share it with a friend. I'd love to get more people to take a listen. Give me a rating on iTunes. That would be great. But otherwise, go out, get your own walk, get moving, get metabolically healthy, and eat your plants. Thanks for listening.